She would have beamed it straight into his heart if she could.
"You're Peter,"
Amy whispered, and went on whispering so that he would be hearing these words.
"You're Peter. You're Peter. You're Peter."
"The blood," thought Michael. "They can smell my blood." He wasn't sure he could stand, let alone run. He had painted a road of red on the floor, leading them straight to him. He pressed his back against the counter and drew his knees to his chest. The virals had entered the store. He heard a kind of wet snuffling, like the noise of hogs rooting in mud. They were sucking the blood off the floor. Michael felt a weird surge of protectiveness. "Hey, leave my blood alone!" On and on went their lascivious slurping. So intense was their focus that Michael began to think about the curtained door. What lay beyond it? Was it a dead end? Or was there perhaps a hallway that led deeper into the building? To the street, even? The doorway was only partially concealed by the counter. For some interval of time, depending on how fast he was able to go, he would be exposed. He peeked around the corner, using the angled mirror to survey the room. The virals, on their hands and knees, were busily pressing their mouths to the floor, their tongues swirling like mop heads. Michael scooted down the length of the counter so he was as close as possible to the door, which was positioned 10 feet behind him and to his right. If he could move the virals to the opposite corner of the room, the counter would obscure him completely. Michael unwound the scarf from his leg. The fabric was bloated with blood. He formed it into a ball, tied off the ends to hold the shape, and rose on his knees, keeping the top of his head just below the lip of the counter. Pulling back his arm, he counted to 3. Then he lobbed the scarf across the room. It impacted the far wall with a splat. Michael dropped to his stomach and began to crawl. From behind him, he heard scurrying, then a series of clicks and snarls. It was better than he'd hoped. The virals were fighting over the rag. He slipped beneath the curtain and kept going. Now he couldn't see a goddamn thing. He crawled another few feet until he was away from the door and attempted to rise. The instant the foot of his injured leg touched the ground was one he was pretty sure he would always remember. The pain was simply spectacular. He reached into his shirt pocket for a box of matches. Fumbling in the dark, he managed to remove one without dumping out the rest, and scraped it on the striker. He was in a narrow hallway of high brick walls that led deeper into the building. Metal racks of empty hangers lined the walls. The air was clearer here, less dust-choked. He pulled the kerchief down from his face. An opening to his left dead-ended in a small room of curtained booths. He looked down. Drops of blood had followed him like a trail of crumbs. More blood sloshed in his boot. The match burned down. He flicked it away, lit another, and went on. 8 matches later, Michael concluded that there was no way out. Branching hallways always led him back to the central corridor. Who designed a building like this? How long before the virals' interest in the rag exhausted itself? And they followed the blood. He came to a final room. It appeared to be a kitchen, with a stove and sink and cabinets lining 2 of the 4 walls. In the center was a small square table covered with open cans and plastic bottles. 2 brown-boned skeletons lay on a cratered mattress, curled together. In all of New York, these were the first human remains Michael had encountered. He crouched beside them. One of them was much smaller than the other, who appeared to be a grown woman with a desiccated tangle of long hair. A mother and her child? Probably they had holed up together during the crisis. For a century they had lain here, their last loving moment captured for all time. It made him feel like an interloper, as if he had violated the sanctity of a tomb. A window. It was covered by a cage. hinged shutters of crisscrossing wire held in place by metal bars bolted to the wall. The two halves were joined with a padlock. The match burned down, scorching his fingertips. He flung it away. As his eyes adjusted, he realized a faint glow was coming through the window, just enough to see by. He looked around the room for something to use as a lever. "Think, Michael." On the table was a butter knife. The floor lurched again with a single horizontal bang. Plaster dust rained down. He wedged the knife into the curved arm of the lock. His hands felt cold and slightly numb, at the edge of his ability to command them. The loss of blood was catching up to him. He tightened his arms and shoulders and twisted the blade hard. It snapped in two. That was it. Enough already. Michael was done. He sank to the floor and braced his back against the wall so that he could see them coming. Peter was standing in a field of knee-high grass. The color of everything was peculiar, possessing an unnatural, off-kilter vividness that accentuated the smallest movements in the landscape. A breeze was blowing. The land was perfectly flat, though in the far distance mountains jostled the horizon. It was neither day nor night, but something in between, the light soft and shadowless. What was this curious place? How had he come to be here? He searched his memory. Only then did he realize that he did not, in fact, know who he was. He felt vaguely alarmed. He was alive. He existed. Yet he seemed to have no history he could recall. He heard the sound of running water and walked toward it. The action was automatic, as if an invisible intelligence were piloting his body. After some time had passed, he came upon a river. The water moved lazily, murmuring around scattered rocks. Leaves spiraled in its current like upturned hands. He followed the river downstream to a bend where it gathered in a pool. The surface of the water was still, almost solid-looking. He felt a peculiar agitation. It seemed that within the pool's depths lay an answer, though the question eluded him. It was on the tip of his tongue, yet when he tried to focus on it, it darted up and away from his thoughts like a bird. He knelt at the edge of the pool and looked down. An image appeared. A man's face. It was disturbing to look at. The face was his, yet it might as well have been a stranger's. He reached out and with his index finger broke the surface. Concentric rings bloomed outward from the point of contact. Then the image reassembled. With this came the sense, distant at first, but growing stronger, of recognition. He knew who he was, if only he could manage to recall. It was as if he were attempting to lift a boulder with his mind. You're Peter. He lurched backward. A dam was bursting in his mind. Images, faces, days, names. They poured forth in a torrent, almost painful. The scene around him, the field and the river and the flat light of the sky, began to disperse. It was washing away. Behind it lay a wholly different reality, of objects and people and events and ordered time. "I am Peter Jackson," he thought, and then he said it. "I am Peter Jackson." Peter stumbled backward. The sword fell from his hand. "What do you think you're doing?" Fanning barked. "I said, kill her." Peter's head swiveled. His eyes narrowed on Fanning's face. It was happening, thought Amy. He was remembering. The muscles of his legs compressed. He sprang. He rammed Fanning headlong. Surprise was on his side. Fanning went sailing. He crashed back down and rolled end over end, coming to rest against a concrete pylon. He rose onto all fours, but his movements were sluggish. He gave his head a horsey shake and spat on the ground.
"Well, this is unexpected."
Then Amy was being lifted. Peter had gathered her into his arms. Together they raced down 43rd Street on soaring strides. Where was he taking her? Then she understood. The partially constructed office tower. She tipped her face skyward, but the dust was too thick to see if the building's upper floors rose above the cloud deck. Peter halted at the base of the elevator shaft. He swung her onto his back, scrambled 10 feet up the shaft's outer structure, guided Amy back around his waist, lowered her through the bars to the elevator's roof, and followed her down. His purpose in all this was unknown to her. He hoisted her onto his back again, using his elbows to compress her legs around his waist to tell her to hold on to him as tightly as possible. All of this had transpired in just a matter of seconds. The elevator's cables, 3 of them, were set into a steel plate affixed to a crossbar on the elevator's roof. Peter gathered the cables into his fists and set his feet wide. Amy, her arms hooked around his shoulders and her legs squeezing his waist like a vice, felt a gathering pressure in his body. Peter began to groan through his teeth. Only then did she grasp his intentions. She closed her eyes. The plate tore free. Amy and Peter launched skyward, Peter gripping the cables, Amy riding his back like the shell of a turtle. 5 stories, 10, 15. The elevator's counterweight plunged past. What would happen when they reached the top? Would they shoot through the roof into space? Suddenly the whole cage shuddered. The counterweight had reached the bottom. The tension on the cable was instantly gone. Hurled upward, Amy found herself looking down at the base of the shaft. She was alone in the air, unattached to anything. Her body slowed as she approached the apogee of her ascent and for a second seemed to hover. "I am going to fall," she thought. How far away the ground was. She would hit it going 100 miles an hour, maybe more. "I am falling." A jolt. Peter, still gripping the cable, had seized her by the wrist. He pumped his legs, shifting his center of gravity to swing Amy in progressively wider arcs. Amy saw his target, an opening in the wall of the shaft not far below them. He flung her away. She landed on the floor and rolled to a halt. They were still inside the dust cloud. The adrenaline of their ascent had sharpened her thoughts. Everything was coming into a fine, almost granular focus. She scrambled to the edge and looked down into a dizzying maw of space. Fanning was climbing up the side of the building. The air concussed with the titanic roar. The building on the opposite side of 43rd Street began to melt straight down into itself, like a man felled at the knees. The floor under Amy began to shake. The vibration deepened. Sounds of buckling metal rippled through the structure as the floor tipped abruptly toward the street. Loose materials, rusted tools, sawhorses, moisture-swollen pieces of drywall, a bucket of nails, slid past her and sailed into the abyss. She was on her stomach, pressing herself to the floor. The angle was increasing. She was slipping. Her hands and feet could gain no traction. Gravity was taking hold. "Peter, help!" The sweet pressure of his hand on her arm halted her slide. He was lying on his stomach, the crowns of their heads just touching. The floor gave another downward lurch, yet he held on, his toes digging into the concrete. With gathering force, he drew her back from the edge.
"Ah,"
said Fanning. His face had appeared above the lip of the floor.
"There you are."
Michael heard a faint metallic ringing from the hallway, the sound of hangers jostling on racks. A short silence ensued, the trail of his blood, crisscrossing the various hallways and doubling back, had momentarily perplexed them. The delay was excruciating. If only he would just pass out. If anything, he felt more alert than ever. Maybe he should make a noise. Call out to them, to get the whole thing over with. Hey, I'm in here, idiots. Come and fucking get it. Such a stupid, arbitrary place to die. He'd never thought he'd die in bed. It wasn't that sort of world, and he wasn't that sort of person. But some damn kitchen? A kitchen. Standing up was out of the question, but the top of the stove lay within his reach. Vertigo sloshed through his brain as he rocked onto his knees. Straining forward, he grabbed hold of the skillet. He spat on the underside and wiped the metal with the hem of his shirt. His reflection was vague and undetailed, more a general outline of a human face than any particular person. But it was what he had. The sounds were coming closer. They raced up the stairs. Two flights brought them to the roof. The dust was as thick as ever, though in the western sky a paler region, weak but discernible, showed the sun's location. They had to get higher. They had to get above the cloud. Amy looked up. The boom of the crane was rocking like the neck of a pecking bird. A long, hooked cable swayed from its tip. A stairway inside the crane's mast ascended to the top. They began to climb. Where was Fanning? Watching them, no doubt. Enjoying himself. Choosing his moment. They clanged the rest of the way to the top. The swaying was getting worse. The whole thing felt unstable, as if at any moment the crane might peel away from the side of the building. They were still inside the cloud. The skyline of Midtown Manhattan was a smoldering wreckage, the destruction continuing to extend outward from its epicenter. A rumble, a cloud, and another building toppled. Broad gaps existed where whole blocks had once stood. "Hello up there?" Fanning was halfway up the mast. Gripping a bar with one hand, he leaned out and waved to them with merry confidence. "Not to worry. I'll be there soon." A narrow catwalk led to the end of the boom. Amy crawled along it, Peter following. The boom was slamming up and down. She kept her eyes aimed forward. She didn't dare look down into the void. Even a glimpse would paralyze her. They reached the end. There was no place else to go. "God damn, I like a view." Fanning had reached the top of the mast and was now standing 50 feet behind them. Back arched, chest puffed out, he let his gaze travel over the ruined city. "You've really made a mess of things, haven't you? Speaking as a New Yorker, I have to say, this brings back some very unpleasant memories." A sudden warmth touched Amy's cheek. She looked to her left, across Fifth Avenue. The glass facade of the building on the far side shone with a faint orange color. Which made no sense. The building faced east, away from the sun. The light, she realized, was a reflection. Fanning huffed a sigh. "Well, looks to me like we've reached the end of the line. I'd ask you to stand aside, Peter, but you don't seem to be a very good listener." The violence of the crane's movement intensified. Far below, the hooked chain was swaying like a pendulum. The glow of the glass was growing brighter. Where was the light coming from? "What do you say? Perhaps the two of you could hold hands and throw yourselves off. I'll be glad to wait." There was a flash, a ray of intense sunlight angling off the steel crown of the Chrysler Building had broken through the murk. It shot Fanning directly in the face. Suddenly the crane tipped away from the side of the building. The bolts attaching the mast to the structure's outer girders were breaking away. With a groan, the boom began to arc over Fifth Avenue, slowly at first, then with gathering velocity. The mast was tipping from its base. They were moving both down and away, the boom falling like a hammer toward the glass tower across the street. it would spear the building at a 45-degree angle, going like a shot.
Oh, please, thought Amy. She was hugging the edges of the catwalk. Make it stop.
Glass exploded around them. The virals did not so much enter as pop into the room. The first one, the Alpha, bounded straight over the table, landing in front of him. Michael thrust the pan out toward its face. It froze. The other two seemed confused, unable to decide what to do. It was as Michael had hoped. He had disrupted their chain of command. He moved the pan a little to the side. The viral's gaze tracked it unerringly. This discovery would have intrigued him if he weren't so terrified. Hardly daring to breathe, Michael slowly drew the pan toward himself. The viral obediently followed. It seemed utterly entranced. Inch by inch, the gap between them closed. Michael shifted the pan to the left, making the viral turn its face. A broken butter knife, thought Michael. I better get this right. He struck. The end of the crane's boom speared the glass tower at the northwest corner of 43rd and 5th at the 32nd floor. Such was the force of impact that it continued its downward course through two more floors, while also embedding itself deeper within the structure. Here, it came to rest in precarious balance, mast and boom forming the upper legs of an isosceles triangle, suspended 300 feet above the street. Amy returned to consciousness with only partial recollection of these events, a sensation of wild descent, culminating in a chaos so total that her mind could not sort its components. She was lying on the floor, her body twisted and her knees drawn up, her left arm extended past her head. Ahead lay a region of light and wind and swirling dust, which after a moment showed itself to be a gaping hole in the side of the building. To her left, the end of the boom sloped downward into the floor, swaying from side to side with a soporific creaking sound. The air was otherwise weirdly still. Something rough and bulky lay beneath her. The chain. It was still attached to the tip of the boom. She felt profound puzzlement at having survived, at the mere fact of being alive. That was her only emotion. As she rolled onto her stomach, her center of gravity, distorted by her long plunge through space, swayed nauseatingly inside her. Nevertheless, she managed to push herself onto her hands and knees and crawled toward the end of the boom. Peter was lying face down on the catwalk. He did not at first appear to be living. There was blood everywhere, and his neck was bent away from her at an unnatural angle. One arm dangled over the edge. But as Amy inched forward, calling his name, she detected a faint respiratory stirring, followed by a twitch of his exposed hand. I'm coming, she cried. I'm coming to get you. Just hang on. She didn't have much time. The crane's tenuous state of balance would not last long. At any moment, the whole thing would wrench free and topple to the street below. Kneeling on the catwalk, Amy slid her hands beneath Peter's shoulders. She was panting for air. Perspiration dripped into her mouth and eyes. In a series of jerks, she drew him to the end of the boom and slid him onto the floor. She rolled him onto his back. His body seemed completely inert, yet his eyes were open. Amy cupped his chin to make him look at her. His tongue swished behind his teeth with a gurgling sound. He was attempting to speak. You're hurt, she said. Don't try to talk. The muscles of his face compressed. His eyes were open very wide. She realized he wasn't looking at her. He was looking behind her. A single word, the last one of his life, burst from Peter's lips. Fanning! The fractured end of the butter knife sank into the creature's eye with a spurt of clear fluid. Michael tried to hold on, but the metal slipped from his fingers as the creature emitted a high-pitched squeal and staggered backward, the blade still embedded.
Now Michael had nothing but the pan to work with. As one of the others shot forward, he swung it as hard as he could, connecting with the side of the creature's skull. He fell onto his side, still pressed to the wall. He raised the pan before his face. The viral batted it away. Michael rolled onto his stomach and buried his head in his arms. Roaring with rage, Fanning blasted into her. A second of confusion and she was on her back, Fanning straddling her waist, claws coiled around her neck. The skin of his face was blackened and charred, the flesh separated in long puckered slits that exposed the musculature beneath. His lips were gone, transforming his mouth into a skeleton's grin of naked teeth. Bits of damp, stringy material dangled from his eye sockets. The orbs within had burst. She tried to breathe, but no air passed the knot of pressure on her throat. Jets of spittle flew from Fanning's mouth into her eyes. Her hands batted at his arms and face, but her efforts were weak and vague. The floor began to shake. The crane was breaking loose. The walls of her vision were compacting around her like a narrowing tunnel. She abandoned her flailing and swept her hands along the floor. "He's blind," she told herself. "He can't see what you're doing." The shaking deepened. With a shriek of torquing metal, the boom jerked upward. There it was, in her hand. The chain. As she wound it around Fanning's neck, his face and body startled, Amy felt a momentary easing of the pressure on her windpipe. The boom had begun to back out the side of the building. She quickly formed a second loop and tossed it over his head. Fanning released her and sat upright. He raised a searching hand to his throat. The slack was running out. "Look for her," said Amy. He made no cry. He exited the world in a blink. He was there 1 second and gone the next, plucked into the whirling dust, his body thus to join the ashes of the vanished city. And then, it was over. For a long time, Michael waited. The silence seemed like a trick. But as the seconds passed and nothing happened, he realized something had changed. There was, all around him, a deep stillness, as if he were alone in the room. He uncovered his eyes and looked. The virals were dead. The one that had knocked the pan away lay at his feet, curled in a fetal position. The other two were on the far side of the room in a similar posture. Even the one with the blade in its eye, from which still issued a trail of blood-tinged fluid. There was something tender about their postures. It was as if, overcome by a sudden exhaustion, they had lain on the floor and gone to sleep. He used the stove to pull himself upright and limped down the hall, following the trail of his own blood. He took a scarf from one of the racks, rebandaged his leg, and ventured outside. A low evening sun, punching through the dust, flared the clouds with color. He made his way east to Lafayette Street and turned north. It wasn't until he'd traveled another block that he knew for certain what had happened. The virals lay everywhere. On the sidewalks, on the street, on the roofs of old cars. All in the same fetal posture, curled like children in their beds, worn out by a too long day. A sight less of death than of a vast collective repose. Their bodies, like the city of which they had so long been a part, were crumbling to dust. It was a scene of wonder. A great, sad, and joyous wonder, too heavy for one mind to bear. He stumbled forward. Uptown, the rumbling of destruction persisted. For months, years, centuries even, the immolation would continue, the great metropolis finally folding itself into the sea. But now, as Michael moved among the bodies, an infinite quiet prevailed, the world pausing in acknowledgement, history held in time's cupped hand. and Michael Fisher did the only thing he could. He fell to his knees and wept. Peter had begun to die. Amy felt his spirit fade. Fanning was leaving him. His eyes were open, yet the light inside was dimming. Soon, it would be gone. "Don't leave me." She lifted his hand and pressed it to her cheek. His flesh was growing cold. The muscles of his face relaxed toward death. "Please," she said, and shuddered with a sob. "Don't leave me alone." The time had come to let him go, to say goodbye. Yet the prospect was unendurable. It could not be accepted. There was a way, perhaps. The gravest act. A betrayal, even. She momentarily had the sensation of being outside her body, watching herself, as she took the shard of glass from off the floor and slashed the edge across her palm. Blood rose from the wound and swiftly gathered in a rich crimson puddle. She took Peter's hand and did the same. A last flicker of doubt. Then she placed his palm against her own and meshed their fingers together. She felt a tiny twitch. With accumulating pressure, Peter folded his fingers over the back of her hand. She closed her eyes. 12. The Wild Beyond. Though my soul may set in darkness, it will rise in perfect light. I have loved the stars too fondly to be fearful of the night. Sarah Williams, the old astronomer to his pupil. 83. At the top of Central Park, away from the destruction, Amy and Michael pitched their camp. It had taken them nearly a week to find each other. The center of the island was blocked by impenetrable mountains of debris. It was on the morning of the sixth day that Amy had heard him calling. Michael emerged from the rubble, a ghostly figure covered with ash. By this time, Amy knew Alicia was gone. Her presence, her spirit, these were nowhere in the world. Still, when Michael told her what had happened, the reality undid her. She sat on the ground and wept. "And Peter?" Michael asked tentatively. Not looking up, Amy shook her head. "No." They remained there for 3 weeks to rest and gather supplies. Michael slowly regained his strength. Together they constructed a simple smokehouse and set snares to catch small game. Elsewhere in the park they found a variety of edible plants, even some apple trees, fat with glossy fruit. Michael worried that the water in the reservoir would be tainted by seawater, but it wasn't. They retrieved the water filter from the Nautilus to clean it of debris. From time to time, they would hear the rumble of another building's collapse, followed by a silence that seemed somehow deeper in the aftermath. At first, this unnerved them, but eventually the noise became commonplace, nothing even to acknowledge. The days were long, the sun hot. One early morning, they awoke to a blast of thunder. Storm after storm crashed through the city. When at last the sun returned, the air was different. A sparkling freshness lay upon the park, dust washed from the leaves of the trees. It was on their final night that Michael produced the bottle of whiskey. He had found it in an apartment building when he'd gone to scavenge tools and clothes. The camp was sealed, the glass caked with dust so thick it was like a layer of soil. Sitting by the fire, Michael was the first to try it. "Absent friends," he said, raising the bottle, and took a long swallow. As his throat bobbed, he began to cough, while also, somehow, wearing an expression of triumph.
"Oh, you're going to like this," he wheezed, and handed it to her.
Amy took a small sip to get the feel. Then, as Michael had done, tipped her head back and let the whiskey fill her mouth. A rich, smoky taste bloomed on her tongue, filling her sinuses with tingling warmth. Michael looked at her inquisitively, eyebrows raised.
"You might want to go easy," he warned. "That's 120-year-old scotch you're drinking."
She took a second pull, savoring the flavor more deeply. "It tastes like the past," she said. In the morning, they broke camp and headed south, through the park and down 8th Avenue. At the water's edge, they loaded the last of Michael's supplies into the Nautilus. He would head first for Florida, where he would restock, then make the long jump to the coast of Brazil, hugging the land until he reached the Strait of Magellan. Once through, a final stop to rest and resupply, and he would set sail for the South Pacific. "Are you sure you can find them?" Amy asked. He shrugged carelessly, though they both understood the danger of what he was attempting. "After all this, how hard can it be?" He stopped, looked at her, then said with a note of caution, "I know you don't think you can come with me. I can't, Michael." He hunted for words. "It's just, how will you get along, all alone?" Amy did not have an answer, at least not one she believed would make sense to him. "I'll have to manage." She looked at his sad face. "I'll be all right, Michael." They had agreed that a clean break would be best. Yet as the moment of separation arrived, this seemed not just foolish, but impossible. They embraced, holding each other for a long time. "She loved you, you know," Amy said. He was crying a little. They both were. He shook his head.
"I don't know that she did.
Perhaps not the way you wanted, but it was the way she knew how." Amy drew back a little and placed a hand to his cheek. "Hold on to that, Michael." They parted. Michael stepped down into the cockpit. Amy cast off the lines. A snap of the sail, and the boat streamed away. Michael waved once over the transom. Amy waved in reply. "God bless and keep you, Michael Fisher." She watched the image recede into the vastness. She put on her pack and hiked north. By the time she reached the bridge, it was early afternoon. A strong summer sun gleamed upon the surface of the water far below. She made her way across and on the opposite side stopped to drink and rest, then donned her pack once more and continued on her journey. Utah was 4 months away. From the observation deck of the Empire State Building, one of the last intact structures between Grand Central and the sea, Alicia watched the Nautilus sail down the Hudson. It had taken her most of 2 days to make the climb. 204 flights of stairs, most in total darkness, an agonizing ascent on her makeshift crutch, and when the pain became too great, her hands and knees. For hours she had lain on various landings, perspiring and breathing hard, wondering if she could go on. Her body was broken. Her body was done. In those places where there was no pain, she felt only a creeping numbness. One by one, the lights of life were winking out inside her. But her mind, her thoughts, these were her own. No Fanning. No Amy. How she'd escaped the subway tunnel she possessed no memory of. Somehow she had been ejected onto dry land. The rest was fragments, flashes. She remembered Michael's face, backlit by sunshine, and his hand reaching down. The water slamming into her, its power immeasurable, large as a planet's. All volition gone, her body plunging and tumbling. The first involuntary gulp, making her choke, her throat opening instinctively to take a second breath, pulling the water deeper into her lungs. Pain, and then a merciful lessening of pain. A feeling of dispersal, her body and her thoughts losing their distinctiveness, like a radio signal fading from range. And then, nothing at all. She'd awakened to find herself in the most perplexing circumstance. She was sitting on a bench. Around her, a small park of overgrown trees and a playground deep in tall feathered grass. Slowly, her awareness expanded. Vast crags of debris surrounded the perimeter, although the park itself was miraculously untouched. The sun was out. Birds twittered in the trees, a peaceful sound. Her clothing was soaked, and her mouth tasted of salt. She sensed a gap in time between remembered events and her present situation, the calm of which seemed wholly anachronistic, like nothing she had ever known. She wondered, somewhat dully, if she was dead, if she was, in fact, a ghost. But when she attempted to stand and the pain volleyed through her body, she knew this wasn't so. Surely death would bring an absence of bodily sensation. That was when she realized it. The virus was gone. Not transmuted into some new state, as it had been in Fanning and Amy, restoring their human appearance while leaving other traits intact. The virus was nowhere inside her at all. Somehow, the water had killed it, and then returned her to life. How was this possible? Had Fanning lied to her? But when she searched her memory, she realized he had never told her in so many words that the water would kill her. She who was neither wholly viral nor wholly human, but poised between the two. Perhaps he had sensed the truth. Perhaps he simply hadn't known. What irony. She had hurled herself off the fantail of the Bergensfjord intending to die. Yet it was the water that had been her salvation in the end. But to be alive, to smell and hear and taste the world in proper proportion, to be alone in one's mind at last. She inhaled the sensation like the purest air. How amazing, how wondrous and unexpected, to be purely and simply a person again. Fanning was dead. The wreckage of the city told her so first. Then the bodies, curled and crumbling to ash. She took shelter in a ruined bodega. Perhaps the others were searching for her. Perhaps they weren't, believing her dead. On the morning of the second day, she heard someone calling. It was Michael. Hello! His voice ricocheted through the becalmed streets. Hello! Is anybody there?
Michael, she answered. Find me. I'm here.
But then she realized that she had not, in fact, spoken these words aloud. It was very puzzling. Why would she not call out to him? What was this impulse to be silent? Why could she not tell him where she was? His calls faded, then were gone. She waited for the meaning of this to become clear, so that a plan might emerge. The days moved by. When it rained, she set pots outside the store to catch the drops, and in that manner she slaked her thirst, though she had neither food nor the means to locate it, a fact that seemed oddly unimportant. She wasn't hungry at all. She slept a great deal, whole nights, many days as well. Long, deep states of unconsciousness in which she dreamed with fascinating emotional and sensory vividness. Sometimes she was a little girl, sitting outside the wall of the colony. At others, a young woman, standing the watch with cross and blades. She dreamed of Peter. She dreamed of Amy. She dreamed of Michael. She dreamed of Sarah and Hollis and Greer, and quite often, of her magnificent soldier. Whole days, whole episodes of her life replayed before her eyes. But the greatest of these dreams was the dream of Rose. It began in a forest, misty, dark, like something from a childhood tale. She was hunting. On cautious, nearly floating steps, she progressed beneath the tree's dense canopy, bow at the ready. From all around came the small noises and movements of game in the brush, yet her targets remained elusive. No sooner would she identify the location of a particular sound, a cracking twig, the rustle of dry leaves, than it would swing behind her or shift to the side, as if the woodland's inhabitants were toying with her. She emerged into an area of rolling fields of open grassland. The sun had set, but darkness was yet to fall. As she walked, the grass grew taller. It rose to her waist, then to her chest. The light, soft, faintly glowing, remained uniform and appeared to have no source. From somewhere ahead, she heard a new sound. It was laughter. A bright, bubbly, little girl laughter.
"Rose,"
she cried, for she knew instinctively that the voice was her daughter's.
"Rose, where are you?"
She tore forward. The grass whipped her face and eyes. Desperation gripped her heart.
"Rose, I can't see you. Help me find you."
"Here I am, Mama."
"Where?"
Alicia caught a flicker of movement, ahead and to the right, a flash of red hair.
"Over here,"
the girl teased. She was laughing, playing a game.
"Can't you see me? I'm right here."
Alicia plunged toward her, but like the animals in the forest, her daughter seemed to be everywhere and nowhere, her calls coming from all directions.
"Here I am," Rose sang. "Try to find me."
"Wait for me.
Come find me, Mama."
Suddenly, the grass was gone. She found herself standing on a dusty road sloping upward toward the crest of a small hill.
"Rose."
No answer.
"Rose!"
The road beckoned her forward. As she walked, she began to have a sense of her environment, or at least the kind of place it was. It was beyond the world she knew, while also a part of it, a hidden reality that could be glimpsed as if from the corner of the eye, but never wholly entered into in this life. With each step, her anxiety softened. It was as if an invisible power, purely benevolent, was guiding her. As she mounted the hill, she heard once again the bright, distant music of her daughter's laughter.
"Come to me, Mama," she sang. "Come to me."
She reached the top of the rise. And there, Alicia awakened. What waited in the valley beyond the hilltop was not yet hers to see, though she believed she knew what it was, as she also knew the meaning of the other dreams, of Peter and Amy and Michael and all those whom she had loved and been loved by in return. She was saying goodbye. A night came when Alicia dreamed no more. She awoke with a feeling of fullness. All she had meant to do had been accomplished. The work of her life was complete. On the crutch she had fashioned from scrap wood, she made her way through the debris, 3 blocks north and 1 block west. Even this short distance left her gasping with pain. It was mid-morning when she began her ascent. By nightfall, she had reached the 57th floor. Her water was nearly gone. She slept on the floor of a windowed office, so that the sun would wake her, and at dawn, she resumed her climb. Was it coincidence that this was the very same morning that Michael set sail? Alicia preferred to think it wasn't. That the sight of the Nautilus, pulling away on the wind, was a sign, and meant for her. Could Michael feel her? Did he in some manner sense that she was observing him from above? Impossible. And yet it pleased Alicia to think so, that he might suddenly look up, startled, as if touched by a sudden breeze. The Nautilus was departing the inner harbor, headed for open sea. Sunlight glimmered dazzlingly upon the water. Clutching the balustrade, Alicia watched as the tiny shape became smaller and smaller, fading into non-existence. Of all people, Michael, she thought. And yet, he had been the one. He had been the one to save her. A tall fence, curved inward at the top, fixed into the top of the balustrade, at once formed a barricade around the perimeter of the platform. Many sections remained, but not all. Alicia had saved a little water. She drank it now. How sweet it was, the scavenged rain. She experienced a profound sense of the interconnectedness of all things, the eternal rising and falling of life. How the water, which had begun as the sea, had ascended, gathered into clouds, and descended from the sky as rain, to be gathered in the pots she'd laid. Now, it had become a part of her. Alicia sat on the balustrade. Below, on the outer side, was a small ledge. She rotated her body, using her hands to assist her disobedient legs over the rail. Faced away from the building, she scooted a few inches forward on the concrete until her feet touched the ledge.
How did one do it? How did one say farewell to the world?
She took a long breath and let the air out slowly. She realized she was crying. Not with sadness. No, not that. Although her tears did not seem unrelated to sadness. They were tears of sadness and happiness conjoined, everything over and done.
My darling, my rose.
Pushing with her palms, she drew herself erect. Space jumped away beneath her. She pointed her eyes to the sky.
Rose, I am coming. I will be with you soon.
Some might have said she fell, others that she flew. Both were true. Alicia Donatio, Alicia of Blades, the new thing, captain of the watch and soldier of the expeditionary, would die as she had lived, always soaring. Night came on. Amy was somewhere in New Jersey. She had left the main thoroughfares behind, moving into the wild backcountry. Her arms and legs were heavy, full of a deep, almost pleasurable exhaustion. As darkness fell, she made her camp in a field of winking fireflies, ate her simple supper, and lay down beneath the stars.
Come to me, she thought.
All around her, and all above, the small lights of heaven danced. A stout full moon rose from the trees, sharpening the shadows.
I'm waiting for you. I'll always wait. Come to me.
A pure silence. Not even the air was moving. Time passed in its languid course. Then, like the brush of a feather inside her,
Amy.
At the far edge of the field, in the boughs of the trees, she saw and heard a rustling. Peter dropped down. He had just eaten, a squirrel or mouse perhaps, or some small bird. She could feel his contentment, the rich satisfaction he had taken in the act, like waves of warmth washing through her blood. Amy rose as he moved toward her, passing among the fireflies. There were so many, it was as if he... as if the two of them were swimming together in a sea of stars.
Amy,
his voice like a soft wind of longing, breathing her name.
Amy, Amy, Amy.
She raised her hand. Peter did the same. The gap between them closed. Their fingers meshed and fell together, the soft pressure of Peter's palm against her own.
Am I?
She nodded.
Yes. And I'm yours? I belong to you?
She sensed his confusion. The trauma was still fresh, the disorientation. She tightened her fingers, pressing their palms together, and held his eyes with hers.
You are mine, and I am yours. We belong to each other, you and I.
A pause. Then, we are each other's.
You are mine, and I am yours. Yes, Peter. Peter.
He held the thought for a moment.
I am Peter.
She cupped his cheek.
Yes. I am Peter Jackson.
Her vision swam with tears. The moonlit night was fantastically still. Everything held in abeyance, the two of them like actors on a stage of dark wings, with a single spotlight falling upon them.
Yes, that is who you are. You are my Peter.
And you are my Amy. As she made her way west, and then for many years after, he was to come to her each night in this manner. The conversation would be repeated countless times. like a chant or prayer. Each visit was as if it were the first. At the start, he retained no memory, either of the previous nights or of the events that had preceded them, as if he were a wholly novel creature in the world, born anew each night. But slowly, as the years became decades, the man inside the body, the essential spirit, reasserted itself. Never would he speak again, though they would talk of many things, words flowing through the touch of their hands, the two of them alone among the stars. But that came later. Now, standing in the field of fireflies beneath the summer moon, he asked her, "Where are we going?" She smiled through her tears. "Home," said Amy.
"My Peter, my love, we are going home."
Michael had cleared the harbor. Over the transom, the image of the city grew faint. The moment of decision was upon him. South, as he'd told Amy, or a new direction entirely. It wasn't even a question. He tacked the Nautilus, turning in a northeasterly direction. The wind was fair, the seas light, with a gentle green color. The following afternoon, he rounded the tip of Long Island and leapt into open sea. 3 days after leaving New York, he made landfall at Nantucket. The island was arrestingly beautiful, with long beaches of pure white sand and crashing surf. There appeared to be no buildings at all, or none he could see. All traces of civilization had been swept away by the ocean's hand. Anchored in a sheltered cove, he made his final calculations, and at dawn, he set sail again. Soon the ocean changed. It grew darker, with a solemn look. He had passed into a wild zone, far from any land. He felt not fear, but excitement, and beneath this, a thrilling rightness. His boat, his Nautilus, was sound. He had the wind and sea and stars to guide him. He hoped to reach the English coast in 23 days, though perhaps that wouldn't happen. There were many variables. Maybe it would take a month, or longer. Maybe he'd end up in France, or even Spain. It didn't matter. Michael Fisher was going to find what was out there. 84. Fanning came to awareness of his surroundings slowly and in parts. First, there was a sensation of cold sand on his feet. This was followed by the sound of waves, gently pushing upon a tranquil shore. After an unknown interval of time had passed, other facts emerged. It was night. Stars thick as powder lay across a sky of velvety blackness, immeasurably deep. The air was cool and still, as after a day-long rain. Above and behind him, atop a steep bluff of eelgrass and beech plum, were houses. Their white faces shone faintly with the reflected light of the moon, which was ascending from the sea. He began to walk. The hems of his trousers were damp. He seemed to have mislaid his shoes, or else he had arrived in this place without them. He had no destination in mind, merely a sense that walking was something the situation called for. The unanticipated nature of his circumstances, its feeling of elastic reality, aroused in him no anxiety. Quite the contrary, everything felt inevitable, reassuringly so. When he tried to recall anything that might have happened prior to his being in this place, he could think of nothing. He knew who he was, yet his personal history seemed devoid of narrative coherence. There was a time, he knew, when he had been a child. And yet that period of his life, like all others, registered only as a collection of emotional and sensory impressions with a metaphoric aspect. His mother and his father, for example, resided in his memory not as individuated beings, but as a feeling of warmth and safety, like being cradled in a bath. The town where he'd grown up, whose name he did not recall, was not a discreet civic unit of buildings and streets, but a view through a window screen of rain pattering.